The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yes, this is part of a long cycle of instability with behind-the-scenes maneuvering by Pakistan's military, but the mechanisms used are constitutional mechanisms because there have been some steps to strengthen the constitution and Pakistan's democracy. Those, because they are enshrined now in the constitution, those remain, and that's important. Can this government come in, and can the next government come in to enshrine other more positive norms as well as constitutional changes? That'll be important to see. But can they ultimately do anything about civilian military relations in that civilian supremacy is ensured? That's still the big question mark. I don't see anything fundamental changing in terms of civil military relations and that balance or civilian supremacy in Pakistan. So that's important to note.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 12th, 2022. Over the weekend, Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, a former international cricket star who later ascended to the role of Prime Minister, was removed from office. Khan lost a no-confidence vote in Pakistani Parliament that came after a few weeks of intense legal and political turmoil. To make sense of the complicated developments, I sat down with Madiha Afzal, a fellow in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. I talked with Madiha about how the situation has developed, how to think about the relative roles of opposition political parties and the military, and what comes next. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 12th. What's going on in Pakistani politics? So I think maybe the best place to start would be, there's so much going on here, and if you could just give us sort of a 3-minute overview of where everything's at and what the outcome is as of recording. And then as we go along, we can unpack the various strains of it.
Well, Pakistan had been facing a political crisis for weeks. It began in earnest on March 8th when the United Opposition to Khan's government filed a motion of no confidence against him. There was a lot of politicking in the next few weeks, but it seemed Khan was set to lose the vote of no confidence when two sort of critical coalition allies moved from Khan's ruling party coalition over to the opposition. The vote of no confidence was set to take place on Sunday, April 3rd, but that day, out of the blue, the deputy speaker of the National Assembly throughout the no confidence motion, saying that it was part of a foreign conspiracy to oust Khan. And then at that point, the president of Pakistan dissolved the National Assembly on Khan's advice. Now, this was extremely controversial, and many legal scholars at that point said that this was unconstitutional. It went directly to the Supreme Court. That following week, Pakistan had sort of a political vacuum. It was unclear what the Supreme Court was going to do, so there was really no government. And the Supreme Court sort of turned this around in pretty record time on April 7th, giving a ruling that basically said all of the decisions of April 3rd taken by the government were unconstitutional and that the vote of no confidence needed to be held that Saturday. So now we come to Saturday, April 9th, and Khan's party filibustered their way through the day. By that evening, it was still not clear whether the vote of no confidence was going to be held. But at that point, it seemed that the speaker would be held in contempt of court if he didn't hold the vote of no confidence. And the Supreme Court was preparing for this. So they opened the Supreme Court late at night. The judges arrived at the Supreme Court. Minutes before midnight, the speaker actually resigned. The deputy speaker of the National Assembly resigned. And at that point, the vote of no confidence did go ahead. And Khan was voted out. And the Monday after, so April 11th, Shehbaz Sharif, the leader of the opposition, a former chief minister, three-time former chief minister of Punjab, former brother of the former prime minister of Pakistan, three-time former prime minister of Pakistan, was elected prime minister. But Khan and his party have resigned from parliament, from the National Assembly. They've been holding huge protests at what they charge is the, you know, a foreign conspiracy to oust Khan. And they're calling this basically an illegitimate imported government, quote unquote, and a government of thieves, of looters, because of the corruption and money laundering charges against them. So it's going to be a very interesting few months ahead in Pakistan.
So a ton to unpack there. I wonder first, where do you think is sort of the natural starting place to think about when things started to go south here? Like, when did you, you know, you follow this stuff fairly closely. Like, when was the point where you started to really raise your eyebrows and get concerned as to what was happening?
Well, I mean, you know, the opposition has made it no secret that it wants Khan out. It charged that Khan came into power with the support of Pakistan's military. It called him, quote unquote, a selected prime minister. It called the Khan government, quote unquote, a hybrid regime. And Khan himself said, you know, we're on the same page with the military. So the opposition made no secret that it wanted Khan out. You know, a year and a half ago, it formed an alliance of parties with whose sole purpose was to oust Khan. But it never really gained traction. I, you know, was following what the opposition was doing. But I was following more closely how Khan's relationship with the military was changing. That started changing around the fall of last year more overtly. There were always rumors of rifts in the relationship, but it didn't really change. But the changes started occurring, and various factors started changing the relationship around the fall of last year. And the opposition's move to oust Khan, you know, again, moves that it had been trying to make for a while, only gained traction essentially this spring, this March, when Khan had essentially fallen out with Pakistan's military. And so that confluence of factors, you know, essentially prompted us all, you know, who look at Pakistan, Pakistan watchers, to know that something different was happening. And then, of course, the various political parties and how they aligned either with the opposition or with Khan was another indication as to how Khan's relationship with the military had unraveled, because the coalition parties in some ways aligning with Khan was an indication that Khan was on his way out.
You mentioned that there was a sort of inflection point in March with Khan and the military. Could you walk us through what was the cause of that? Right? Like, is that something that was anticipated? Was there like a precipitating event?
Well, the inflection point, I would say, probably happened last fall. And then, you know, I think the factors just added on to one another to make it so that at this point, the opposition in March had enough traction. Essentially, the military had finally withdrawn their support from Khan, and the opposition had enough traction to go ahead and sort of file this no confidence move and be reasonably confident about it. So I would point to three factors. The first is last fall, the appointment of the chief of the Inter-Services Intelligence, Pakistan's intelligence agency. Khan, you know, waffled on the military's suggested appointment for weeks. That there was a lot of speculation then of a rift between Khan and the military, and this causing embarrassment to the military, which could lead to a rift. And essentially, the question was on whether Khan wanted to transfer out the then intelligence chief, who had been seen as a Khan loyalist and who had helped Khan behind the scenes in the election of 2018, whether Khan wanted him to be posted out, whether Khan wanted him. There was speculation that he wanted him to be the next army chief. So the dilly-dallying on that, many of us wondered then what it would cost Khan. That's the first. The second factor was domestic governance issues, in particular with the leadership of Punjab, Pakistan's largest province. Khan's choice of chief minister had been controversial for 3.5 years. The military didn't like him. The coalition allies didn't like him. Even some of Khan's own party lawmakers didn't like him. And there had been calls for that chief minister's ouster that Khan had resisted. And ultimately, you know, sort of governance issues and sort of not failing, not being able to perform in Punjab was something that made him lose the favor of both the coalition and the military. And in the domestic governance issues, I would also put, you know, the pressures on the economy, rising inflation, rupee that had fallen in terms of its value relative to the dollar, rising unemployment. You know, rising inflation, of course, it's something that countries are suffering from the world over at this point, but it was hurting the regular Pakistani. So that was a second bucket, sort of domestic governance issues. And I would say the third bucket was rifts that started emerging on foreign policy that have only become fully apparent in recent weeks. And those rifts really have to do with, you know, Khan's approach towards Russia, China, and the U.S. Essentially, Khan said that he wanted an independent foreign policy and he wanted good relationships with Russia, China, and the U.S. But in the face of a cold shoulder from the Biden administration, no phone call from President Biden to Imran Khan since President Biden took office last year, Khan's visits very recently in February to Beijing, and then a controversial visit in February to Moscow, ended up looking like he was embracing Russia and China at the expense of the U.S. On the other hand, the military in Pakistan desires a more balanced relationship, something where it has a very overtly good relationship with the U.S. And the chief of army staff, actually, in a speech about 9 days ago, explicitly took a much stronger stance against Russia's invasion of Ukraine than Khan ever did. So he said that, you know, we cannot condone this. And there seems to have been a discrepancy, a falling off the same page, if you will, on foreign policy. And the military, in many ways, Pakistan's military establishment is considered to really run foreign policy behind the scenes. So this kind of divergence on foreign policy, this getting off the same page, no doubt hurt the relationship.
And you'd spoken before about the position of the opposition here. And when you say opposition, do you mean sort of a unified front of parties? Sort of, is it the case that, you know, in Pakistan, there's a united front among all the different parties that are not Khan's party to, you know, push him out and to oppose his rule? Or is it the case that, you know, over time, because of mounting universal opposition to his tenure in office, the parties sort of coalesced together and gathered steam?
That's a great question. So the opposition parties, the two largest ones that have now united into united opposition are the Pakistan People's Party and the Pakistan Muslim League, Nawaz. And these two parties were at loggerheads with each other since the 1980s. They alternated governments, one clamoring for the ouster of the other. But in 2008, after Pakistan's last stint of military rule under Pervez Musharraf, these two parties entered into a compact, kind of a political compact, that they would want to preserve kind of democracy at all costs. And since then, they've had a more conciliatory relationship with each other. And while, you know, the PPP ruled from 2008 to 2013 and the PMLN ruled from 2013 to 2018, these sort of traditional rivals, when Khan came into power, this third party that then emerged as the largest party in the 2018 election, they basically coalesced into an opposition and other parties joined them, including an Islamist party that doesn't win a lot of seats in government, the Jamiat-e-Ulema-Islam Fazl, headed by an Islamist named Maulana Fazlur Rahman. That party doesn't win a lot of seats in government, but it brings out a lot of street power. So these were the three major parties that formed that opposition alliance, whose sole purpose, really, was to oust Khan. And they were actually saying that, you know, Khan is part of this, a selected, as I said, quote unquote, figure of the Pakistani military. And they argued against the military's interference in politics in 2020 when this alliance formed. But, you know, if you take a step back, this is part of a much longer cycle of instability in Pakistan, where opposition parties always clamor for the ouster of the sitting civilian government and the sitting prime minister, whoever the opposition party tends to be. Essentially, the incumbent government or the prime minister loses power when they fall out of favor with Pakistan's so-called establishment, its military. So in that sense, this is not a new event or not a new feature of Pakistani politics, but it's sort of age old. And the opposition parties that coalesce can be parties that have traditionally been rivals, but their objective is working for the ouster of the sitting party.
So the other factor that we've maybe talked about a bit less is sort of public perception of Khan outside of just the parties and outside of the military. So maybe just as first as way of background, could you describe to people who may not know what Khan's sort of past life is and what his stature within the country was, and then maybe chart over time, like, what has been the sort of trajectory of how people within the country have felt about him from, you know, the time that he declared his candidacy to his years in office?
Well, Khan rose to popularity in Pakistan in the 1980s as a cricket star and took cricket crazy Pakistan to its first World Cup victory, to its only World Cup victory to date in 1992. So he was an international cricket star, an international renowned athlete, also a playboy, and turned to politics after sort of this, you know, time where he, through philanthropic giving, founded a network of cancer hospitals in Pakistan. He turned to politics and started out really small. It was just him in parliament for a long time from his party. He eventually, you know, his star rose as Pakistan's military started getting very disillusioned with the two main parties at that point, the PMLN and the PPP, and saw in Khan an alternative politician. And Khan's main stance, it's a populist stance, and it's an anti-corruption platform. So he rails against the corruption of the parties, the old parties, if you will, the PPP and the PMLN. And he argues for an Islamic welfare state for the country. You know, and he's mobilized the youth, the urban youth in particular, of Pakistan, and who sort of are a significant part of his base. So with that, with his party doing well in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province that neighbors Afghanistan, and with the support and the backing in some ways of Pakistan's military, he first became His party became the third largest party in Pakistan in the 2013 elections, and then finally won a plurality and was able to cobble together a thin majority through these coalition parties to form government in 2018.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And so when you think about the events of the past, month or so, or even extending out into the fall, what do you think has sort of been the relative weight and influence of A, the military, B, these opposition parties, and C, just declining public satisfaction with his tenure in office? Like, what do you attribute the bulk of the weight to his downfall to?
Well, the opposition parties, coalescing, staying united, seizing upon the economy as the reason to ask for Khan's ouster. That's the ostensible story here, right? The overt story. But ultimately, this could not have happened had the military, the establishment, not withdrawn their support from Khan. So without Khan losing that support, the opposition parties, sort of seizing upon the problems with Pakistan's economy wouldn't have gone anywhere. It is the factor that tipped things away from Khan and into the opposition's favor is that the military withdrew its support from Khan. Now, all of this happens behind the scenes. So it's very difficult to see in Pakistan how the maneuvering behind the scenes occurs. But it's unmistakable that things have gone not in Khan's favor. Things have gone against Khan in recent weeks. First, key coalition allies stepping away from Khan, including one party that had ostensibly drawn close to Khan and formed the coalition government at the behest of Pakistan's military. So that, there was a behind the scenes sort of maneuvering that led the coalition parties away from Khan. Two, when Khan's government took unconstitutional steps in order to dissolve the National Assembly last Sunday on April 3rd, the Supreme Court decision that came out was clearly a constitutional win. It was something that sided in favor of Pakistan's constitution. But one has to remember that this is a Supreme Court that has had a checkered history in Pakistan. It is a Supreme Court that had rubber-stamped military coups based on what it called a doctrine of necessity, and it's taken other questionable decisions. So the fact that it came out so heavily, yes, in the right way, pro-constitution, some are saying it wouldn't have done had the military prevailed upon the Supreme Court, had it kept its support behind Khan to rule the opposite way. So the military's withdrawal of support here was key in the Supreme Court actually taking the right step to uphold the constitution and to let the constitution prevail. Again, we can come to the events of Saturday when, at the last minute, the Supreme Court made it clear that it would hold the speaker and the deputy speaker in contempt of court if the vote of no confidence wasn't held. Again, it taking this stance is important. Again, it upheld the Constitution, but would it have taken it had the military pressured it to do otherwise? So the military's standing back, that so-called neutrality, ends up playing a crucial role in the chips aligning against Khan. And ultimately, that's the factor that weighs the most, though all the other factors have mattered and all the other factors were needed as well.
I wonder just what has surprised you the most about the way this has unfolded, right? In some respects, like you describing this, everything, you know, it makes intuitive sense, but what has been the biggest surprise to you?
Going back to 2018, the relationship between Khan and the military, if you had asked me then, I would have said, you know, Khan might be the one prime minister in Pakistan to be in office for 5 years because of that close relationship with the military. Now, other prime ministers have had close relationships with the military in the past, including the brother of the new prime minister, Nawaz Sharif. He was a favored politician of Pakistan's military in the 1980s, and that's how he rose to power. And you know, that relationship also cooled. So there's a history of these relationships cooling, but sort of Khan's particular insistence the first 3 years he was in power, up till this year, that he and the military were on the same page, made many of us think that they had arrived at some sort of equilibrium where Khan had figured out how to manage that relationship in order to preserve his hold on power. And to me, the most surprising thing is how that has unraveled in recent months. And now the new politics that Khan is running, right? So you know, Shehbaz Sharif being the prime minister of Pakistan, the next few months are going to be really interesting because there's going to be the next election sometime in the next few months to a year. That election campaign will be fascinating. But to me, the really interesting things are what is already happening on the ground in Pakistan. So yesterday, as I mentioned, Khan's party led huge rallies in his support. And there were two things to note. Their anti-military stance, an overt anti-military stance, which is quite stunning to see in public protests in Pakistan. And the stance that this is a foreign conspiracy. They're basically alleging, they're pointing fingers at Pakistan's military and, you know, at the US and the opposition as all being in cahoots for Khan's ouster. And sort of that overt stance and then Khan's sort of stance today, he and his party resigning from parliament, basically calling for fresh elections, saying that's the only way forward. You know, this is sort of not working within the system, but this is a politics of agitation. And it's not surprising when it comes to Khan because, you know, he was an opposition politician in 2013 with this sort of politics of agitation, led huge rallies against Nawaz Sharif then. It's not surprising, but it's surprising how quickly he has gone from being the military's favored one to running this opposition agitational street politics again. Within a few days, we have seen this happening, and that's been quite striking.
So what comes next? Like, what are the next steps, and how will we sort of get a sense of who might be in charge in the coming weeks, months, years?
These are big questions. So right now, Shehbaz Sharif is prime minister. The next elections have to be held by the summer of 2023. Shehbaz Sharif has a formidable task in front of him. So the most important thing for him is going to be the domestic economy. You know, figure out inflation, figure out employment, not easy tasks, right? Not easy asks of anyone. And he has a very short time horizon to turn these things around. And, you know, he has the next election to look forward to. So the real prize is not being in power right now. The real prize is figuring out how to win the next election, to figure out how he can turn things around so that that helps him in the future, to figure out if they can do something about the corruption cases against them in order to bring perhaps Nawaz Sharif back into the fold, who remains very popular. He is the charismatic one of the two brothers. He's the one who's been prime minister many times, obviously, 3 times. So that's the task for him sort of domestically. And, you know, he has this foreign conspiracy allegation to deal with, where Khan's supporters certainly, and perhaps others in the population, believe this foreign conspiracy theory. And he has to rebut it and discredit it. How does he manage to do that? So if he manages to repair the recently broken, in many ways, relationship with the U.S., does Khan hurt him, basically saying, look, he was in cahoots with the U.S.? Or is Sharif able to walk that fine line of actually repairing that relationship with the U.S. while also rebutting that foreign conspiracy? That's all on Sharif's side. Khan is going to run a polarizing political campaign. That much is clear. You know, he's in some ways been in campaign mode since the vote of no confidence was filed against him. So it's going to be a polarizing campaign. Ultimately, it's a parliamentary democracy. So what matters is who is fielded by each of these parties in the various constituencies in the country, and who can win at least a plurality of votes and have enough coalition allies to form a majority in parliament. Now, in Pakistan, a lot of that comes down not to big national issues, but to whether you have what are so-called electables on your side. You know, basically, lawmakers who engage in kind of patronage politics. In their local constituencies, they give people jobs, they provide favors, and that's how they get elected. And these lawmakers move from one party to the other, depending on where they see the next ruling party is going to fall. So ultimately, it also depends on which party is seen as the party more favored by the Pakistani military. You know, is Khan's relationship with the military, is the rift between that relationship for good? Can that be repaired? Or does the PMLN, Sharif's party, manage to ingratiate itself with the military enough so that, it's considered favored? All of these factors basically, dictate who comes into power. And interestingly enough, Pakistan has an incumbency disadvantage at the national level. So whoever is in power in the current government loses power in the next one. So the difficult task ahead of Shehbaz Sharif is he's in power for a few months. He needs to make sure that those few months don't turn into an incumbency disadvantage for him.
So I want to wrap up with two sort of bigger picture questions, the first of which is about the foreign policy issue. So you mentioned that one of the three, big factors precipitating the decline here was disagreement about foreign policy issues. So looking forward, what do you think this, all the news and all the changes will mean for, Pakistan's broader foreign policy approach? And do you see things changing? Do you see things changing in an enduring way? Or is this sort of a temporary flare-up that will result in the status quo foreign policy-wise?
Well, Pakistan had been shifting its foreign policy for a bit now. Post the U.S., and actually even before that, as the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan was becoming imminent, Pakistan was kind of shifting to a, post-America and Afghanistan era, basically saying, look, first, we want good relationships with, both China and the U.S. We don't want these relationships to be considered zero sum. Just because we have a good economic relationship with China doesn't mean we can't have one with the U.S. But clearly saying we don't want all our eggs to be in one basket. We want to pursue good relationships with both countries. Two, it was asking the world to look at it not just in terms of security, not just in terms of Afghanistan, but to look at it on a multidimensional kind of spectrum. In particular, take a look at its economy, which Pakistan wanted more investment in. including from the West. So when the Biden administration came into power in 2021, Pakistan came to it with sort of this geoeconomics pitch, saying, we want a relationship based on a good economic relationship, not, you know, thinking only about security. And, you know, we want the U.S. to sort of fundamentally rethink its relationship. Now, the U.S., given the withdrawal from Afghanistan, given its priorities were elsewhere, wasn't interested in some ways in taking Pakistan up on that offer right then. But that's Pakistan's, you know, the through line here is that kind of pitch. And the question now is whether it finds takers, essentially, for that pitch, while still maintaining sort of security cooperation with the U.S. on Afghanistan, you know, which the military was always keen on doing with the U.S. and which ostensibly Sharif's government will be sort of more positive towards or more amenable towards. So, you know, Pakistan will want to balance its relationship, perhaps move a little bit away from Russia relative to, you know, what had been looking like a Russia-leaning posture, even though it was remaining neutral, but had looked like a Russia-leaning posture because of Khan's visit to Moscow. Perhaps Pakistan will take a bit of a step back from that. But it will seek to maintain relationships with both China, which Sharif's party, by the way, has had a close relationship with. And the flagship of the Belt and Road Initiative was launched in Pakistan in 2015 under Sharif's brother's government. So the relationship with China will remain strong. The relationship with the U.S., Sharif may want to pursue, but that really depends on whether the U.S. engages. He's also not going to want to, you know, step into this foreign conspiracy theory before the election in the sense that he's not going to want to pursue a positive relationship with the U.S. if it comes at the expense of him losing the next election, because that's something that Khan is going to want to tout in the campaign. So the major, perhaps, you know, recalibration or the major statements on foreign policy may come after the next election, but sort of right sizing or the shifts that had already been in play, you know, moving back towards those will probably happen pretty soon.
And to close, I wonder what, looking back and reflecting on all this, what does it reflect about the state of democracy in Pakistan? Does it reflect, in some ways, you know, the stability of institutions, like, you know, the Supreme Court ruling in a way that, as you characterize, sort of supports democratic values, or does it reflect more ongoing political turmoil, democratic vulnerability? What do you make of it?
On the whole, I would say that the building blocks of Pakistan's democracy remain as they were, right? Which is, you know, it's overtly a parliamentary democracy, but behind the scenes, the military plays a role. And whichever political party is in power and the opposition has to contend with that. And that's sort of the landscape in which they function. Now, a few changes have been made since 2008, since Pakistan's last stint with military rule, to strengthen the constitution so that its democracy, its parliament, gets strengthened. And those are what we're seeing play out. So the fact that Khan was ousted through a vote of no confidence and not in any other way is reflective of that. It's important to note that those were steps forward. It's also important to note that Pakistan's military is not interested in being in power overtly. It doesn't want to take over the reins. It does not want to rule directly. It's content to rule behind the scenes. It's content not to show any overt interference. That's also notable. That was not always the case. So, you know, in the long sort of stretch or long view of Pakistani history, yes, this is part of a long cycle of instability with behind-the-scenes maneuvering by Pakistan's military, but the mechanisms used are constitutional mechanisms because there have been some steps to strengthen the constitution and Pakistan's democracy. Those, because they are enshrined now in the constitution, those remain, and that's important. Can this government come in, and can the next government come in to enshrine other more positive norms as well as constitutional changes? That'll be important to see. But can they ultimately do anything about civilian-military relations in that civilian supremacy is ensured? That's still the big question mark. I don't see anything fundamental changing in terms of civil-military relations and that balance or civilian supremacy in Pakistan. So that's important to note.
And that is a perfect place to wrap. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. Here, you also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. You can join us later this April, for example, when we'll be hosting a joint live show with Georgetown Law about the implications of the Russian invasion on the international legal system. You can rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Shatter, and the latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th, The Aftermath. And you can check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patiahau, and your audio engineer this week was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and as always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.